Good morning, and let me welcome first off our Facebook friends and YouTube friends from around the world. We appreciate you joining us here in Calgary, Alberta. We've got a really nice banner back here. It's just covered up.
It's backwards.
I'm just too big. Thank you guys so much for joining us, and to our mammoth crowd that we have here this morning in Calgary. Hear all those voices. My gosh, it's just the room is reverberating with the sound of the multitudes. It's almost like a revelation experience here. Thank you guys for being here this morning. And we're going to continue on with our series in the book of Heroes, but it's, well, he is a hero, isn't he, right? He's definitely become the hero, a new hero of the gospel revolution, and that is our friend Apollos. How does it feel to get to know somebody out of the New Testament that you just remember his name mentioned occasionally? Isn't that pretty cool? And then all of a sudden, you got somebody who is, there's another book, there's another writer in the New Testament other than Paul that preached the gospel. I don't know why that just thrills me so much that we have a confirming writer, that this was not just Paul's doctrine, but that this man learned from Paul. And his encounter with Priscilla and Aquila, what a wonderful thing that was able to happen, and for them to be able to understand and come to understand the issues that were taking place, and then for Paul to be able to have the time that he had to be able to share with Apollos. Now, these guys, for such a long time, they spent more than a decade together, kind of joined at the hip, and that experience together with them, the number of things that he says, we didn't read all of the verses in the New Testament about the relationship between Paul and Apollos, nor with Priscilla and Aquila and Apollos, nor with Apollos and many others. Just like at the end of Titus, Paul says, the one guy, which I can't remember his name, who's an attorney, and Apollos, and told him that he needed them both with him. So when you're out preaching and you need an attorney and you need Apollos with you, you're getting in the thick of it, right? So there were some things that were happening. I think that our ability to begin to expand our minds as to what might have been happening during this time, the interaction between these people, and when the gospel was being shared with people, we've come to understand that the writers of the New Testament did not agree with each other. Now, that's not by my summation, and that's not my observation. It is what they said. They said, we disagree with each other. And they disagreed with each other quite vehemently, to the point where that even Paul said that he, in the very first part of the book of Galatians, he says that he encountered Peter, James, and John, and he said that he withstood Peter to the face. And he said, you are to be blamed. He said that Peter, James, and John were not walking uprightly according to truth. Now, those are some pretty strong statements for the guys that all of their statues are erected around the world. That, you know, what is their little epitaph at the foot of their statues? Does it say, walked not according to truth? You know, I bet that epitaph didn't make it in there on the bottom of their statues. But that was Paul's opinion of these gentlemen, that they did not walk uprightly according to truth. Thus, we have a fragmented gospel at best that is spread around the world because we've been trying to integrate the teachings of Peter, James, and John And we've been trying desperately to integrate the teachings of Paul with these. Now, when that happens, you almost deal with a schizophrenic way of viewing the gospel. Because you read on one hand about the grace of God and how we're freed from the law, and then you read James, and James says, you foolish man who says it's all by faith and not by law, you know, and they disagree with each other on so many key issues. Paul had a way of identifying how you offend the grace of God. Paul was like he was the guru about grace, you know. And Paul said there's three ways you can offend God's grace. And this is listed in different places in the book of two of them, actually. I think actually two of these places are in the book of Hebrews. So this would have been Apollos listing two of the ways to offend God's grace, and Paul telling us about one in the book of Galatians. Paul said, isn't that interesting? Now we've got to divide up who said what about what insults about grace. You know, I used to ascribe all of these to Paul, but now I realize two of them actually came from Apollos. That's pretty interesting. I just learned something, Jeannie. Yeah. So Paul said that you offend the grace of God if you have any concept in your mind that obedience to a law adds to your relationship to God. He says you're fallen from grace. Apollos said that if you're still going around saying there's an angry God going to be judging people, he says that you have offended the grace of God. Apollos said if you go around confessing your sins all the time, that you also have insulted the grace of God. Now, when you begin to understand what grace is, you understand why, if you're talking about judgment, you're offending God's grace, because God's grace and judgment are opposites. Wade was teaching us last night, mercy rejoices against judgment. So grace and mercy walk hand in hand. So if you're preaching judgment, you're not preaching grace. If you're preaching judgment, you are not preaching mercy, right? And if you're telling people that they're still under sin, you're telling people they're still under law. It's either, and Paul says, we are no longer under the law. If we're not under the law, we are not under sin. You can't be under grace and be under sin all at the same time. Law is the strength of sin, as Paul made it very clear. And then, of course, Apollos' declaration in chapter 12 about going around thinking that God is still chastening and scourging people, and he said that this, too, is an insult to God's grace. So we have two men agreeing on this. Now, to me, that's exciting. I used to have to ascribe that Paul's the only one that said this, but now we got two guys saying it, as we have found that this book in Hebrews is written by this incredible writer called Apollos. What we're going to cover today is chapter 8 in Hebrews of the letter that was written by Apollos. An eloquent man, we're told. A man that was mighty in the scriptures, we are told. A man that was from Alexandria, we are told. A man who, from the area that he was in and what the area he was raised in, spoke a refined form of Greek that Paul did not teach in, that Paul didn't know. We know that there's at least 40 words in the book of Hebrews that shows up that does not show up anywhere else in the New Testament at all, that this man Apollos used to describe the gospel. And he draws these parallels. We see also the absence of Paul's personality. Paul's personality is just so identifiable. And and there is none of that. There's none of the sarcasm. There is not one ounce of sarcasm in the book of Hebrews. Can't be Paul. This guy was sarcastic to the core. It just can't be Paul. So by coming to those conclusions, I think the number one question I've gotten as we started emphasizing this is why is it important? because it's just as important to know who wrote something on any level. My goodness, if we took politics, what if you mistook somebody from the right writing a letter and it was actually somebody from the left? I would say if you thought it was somebody from the left, you would switch. If your politics were left, you'd say they were right. And vice versa. Because you see, we're that way. That's what we do in so many political issues. The one thing about politics that I have fun with, because I just don't get into politics, but the number one thing that I like about it is to watch how that one group stands for something vehemently until it's the other side who's promoting it, and then they're completely against it. Yeah. Isn't that amazing how that minds can be so quickly altered? So that's why I like the gospel. The gospel has a very clear message to it, and we just stay on the side of the gospel. But we do compare the gospel to religion. That is for sure, because religion is the opposite to the gospel. We could go into all of chapter 7. We cleared chapter 6. Wasn't that amazing? Man, I'm telling you, I loved going through chapter 6, the last part of chapter 6, and all of chapter 7. We found out a lot of things. I mean, if nothing else, it was worth coming here to find out what the difference between good and evil is. That was something that was worth finding out. And we really do get to have this powerful understanding that we've locked into something that's beautiful. We have locked into something that is totally and completely beautiful. And we know what we have left behind, that is for sure. So as we go on into this here in the reason that I'm skipping chapter 7, let me show you why I'm skipping chapter 7, because of the way chapter 8 says. Now, of these things which we have spoken, this is the sum. You know, we're doing the cliff notes now. We're, instead of going into detail about chapter 7, we're looking to chapter 8, and because of our restriction of time also. So we'll just look at this here on chapter 8, and he says, well, this is the sum of what we were talking about, so why not listen to the sum? Here we go. Now, of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. This is the sum. We have such a high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of majesty in the heavens. Now, this term heavens is actually the same term as the word heavenlies. Anytime we think about heaven, remember, we always think about up there, right? But the studies that we've done recent, we understand that the heavenlies are in here. So regardless of where you see Jesus seated at the right hand of the throne, blah, 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 in the heavenlies, and this is in the heavenlies, we went into some detail on the heavenlies, and the heavenlies are in here. This is where the heavenlies are. And this is where Christ dwells in God and God in us in the heavenlies. We've been given all spiritual blessings in heavenly places. So these spiritual blessings that we have are not in the heavenly places. They are in heavenly places because this is the kingdom of God. This is where we dwell. This is where you are. And verse 2. A minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. Now, this is a picture of something that took place before Genesis 1:1. God designed all of this to be in place. Then he created the place where it would take place. Now, that really ought to make you feel pretty special. God created the thing that was going to happen to whom it was going to happen and where he was going to live, because God, according to Paul's teachings, God decided, you know, hey, heaven, you remember that song we used to sing? Heaven is a wonderful place filled with glory and grace. I'm going to see my Savior's face because heaven is a wonderful place. I want to go there. So as wonderful as that was, you know, real estate is real estate, right? And when you decide to move, are you going to move to a better place or a lesser place? You know, if you own everything, right? You, if you own everything, where are you going to move to? Now, so I love this picture, and I hope I'm portraying it well. All right, so God in Christ are living in heaven with all of its grandeur and everything that you and I can think of, and they begin to plan to move. Now, in their great plan, they come up with this sketching. They come up with this idea. They come in with this thing that has a picture of you in it. They have a picture of a multitude of billions around the earth, and in a situation where that they will be able to express themselves from generation to generation to generation to generation through multitudes and multitudes and multitudes of people with multitudes and multitudes of personalities, with multitudes and multitudes of heights and weights and sizes and grins and smiles and eyes and skin, and as different as we are all the same. Isn't that amazing? And they say, hey, I like this design right here. This is the design we want. Okay, yeah, but where are we going to build our house? Where are we going to build the house that we are going to, you know, it's kind of nice wandering around in heaven, but it'd be nice to have a home. So in the mind of God, as with any architect, with anyone who's building a home, and you can ask Wade this, where do those plans first get laid out? They get laid out here, don't they? Then they get on paper, all right? So here you have this. Now read this again. A ministry of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. Now, you've got to understand that everything that came out of the portrayal of the temple, of the sanctuary, of all of this, were all types and shadows of the real. The real was developed before Genesis 1:1, when God said, "Let there be light." Wow. You were in the mind of God before God said, "Let there be light." Because what was the light for? The light was the place where he was going to develop the area, where he was going to put the planets and the stars, and a planet on which he was going to put a creature in which was a house, as Christ told us all the way through, you are God's house, you are God's temple. Don't you understand? Don't you understand that we developed you long before? And now I am here as the prototype of God living in the human race, in the new temple. I'm the prototype of that. Now, I'm getting ready to do a work that will cause the transition, this magical thing to happen, where God himself and I, his son, will integrate you and the Father together as one, and we will dwell with you, we will tabernacle with you. You are our mansion, and we're about to move into our mansion. You see, all of this was created for the purpose of where do we put our mansion? And that's the second thing you look for after you decide this is the perfect house. What's the next thing? Where are we going to put it? Right? And they said, well, we just can't find any place up here. You know, I don't know where are we going to put it? Let's create time and space. And let's put it in a place that is so beautiful. Let's put it in a place that is so spectacular. Let's put it in a place that's fluid, that's in motion, because that's what God is. He's fluid, he's in motion. But he says, how can we stay in motion and stay fluid and move within a structure? We'll make it into billions that we move into. Now, God could only live in that which is perfect. And he made it very clear that that's not how he created us. He created us subject to corruption. Paul said it was a necessary phase in the process of construction until the final product was to be produced. And when the perfect time had come, after trying to show us types and shadows and temples and holies of holies and outer courts and inner courts and priests and all of these things, he showed us that and to try to explain to us in an external way, because he had to communicate to our brains people that he made as individuals, because God is not going to house himself in something that is doesn't have its own individuality, that doesn't have its own mind. Number one, that just wouldn't be any fun. That is what this is portraying. Now, you say, boy, you're extrapolating a lot out of this verse, but it's because of what we know, what Paul taught about how that all of this was created in the mind of God and in the mind of Christ before the foundations of the world, before the creation, before anything was created, you were in the mind of God as his home. And I'll guarantee you, man, if you ever built a home and it wasn't ready yet, how many times have you driven by to look at it? Wow, things are coming along nicely. Oh, look at that. No, we didn't want that way. Let's change that a little bit. So here we go through the process. I'm not sure that things needed to be changed. I'm just trying to create a picture here for you that will let you know the value that you have. My God, do you know how precious you are? Do you know how valued you are? I mean, there's nothing closer to somebody's heart than their home. And you are God's house. You are his place. You are where he dwells. Now, I'm in verse 2. I don't know how long we're going to take this morning. I'm in verse 2 and we're 26 minutes in. A minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. Now, you do know you are the true tabernacle, right? But you see, the Lord pitched this tabernacle before the other tabernacle was made to show us kind of what it's like. He said, for every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices. Oh, man, I'm telling you. So the high priest was given to them to show how that the high priest was the one who went in to the tabernacle. The high priest was the one who went in to take care of all of the repairs that needed to be made. The high priest was the one that went in once a year to maintain and service the tabernacle and those who were living in it, and those who participated in it. And thank God, at the end of times, our high priest moved in to do the final work to make the new dwelling place absolutely perfect. And he did make it absolutely perfect. He made it absolutely perfect. And at the moment of time where the great high priest was not doing, no more repairs needed to be done. Perfection had been reached, Righteousness was perfect. And that regardless of the condition or the actions or the way the house looked, for God, it was perfect. And move-in date came. After the high priest had finished his work, they moved in. And it's been that way now for over 2,000 years. But the thing that's important here is not just the fact that that happened. You need to know when that happened. That blueprint was laid out before there was this statement made. Let there be light. For every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifice, ordained to give gifts and sacrifices. Wherefore, it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer. For if he were here on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that these are priests that offer gifts and sacrifices according to law. So there's no way that Jesus could be a high priest here, right? He could not be a high priest in that tabernacle because that tabernacle was governed by the law. This tabernacle is governed by grace. He could not govern where law existed. He could not be a high priest where law was where law was present. That was all just a type and shadow for us. I tell you, I don't get what's happening to me today. I'm telling you, this is just having such impact on me. I apologize. It says, thank you. I'll get through it somehow, I promise. You may have to pick me up on a puddle out of the floor. I don't know. It's beginning to look that way. And that's the thing. I'm overwhelmed with the picture, this concept, and it's not a concept. This is truth. This is something like what Wade was sharing last night. Truth is truth. And it's not my truth. It's not your truth. Why is it truth? Because whether anybody, Buddhist, Hindu, hen don't, it doesn't make any difference which one you're in. It doesn't make any difference what political persuasion or anything else. This is truth for every human being on this planet. And that's what makes it truth. Truth is that which is applicable to everyone on earth. That's what truth is. I'm sorry, but each denomination, you have your own truth. Every religion has its own truth. And until you find something that says to everyone, we're all equal, we're all one, you haven't found truth. That there's one thing that affects all and affects all equally, and it's not a measurement of one against the other, but instead makes us all absolutely one on a level that could help us, you know, The issues that divide us, skin color, everything that divides us. Do you know why those things divide us? Because we're divided spiritually. You see, we're struggling hard to stop racism. You'll never stop racism until you stop spiritual bigotry. That's the only place that racism or any other divides me. You know, you're tall, you're short, you're big, you're small, you're blonde, you're black, you're this, you're that. And we find places, you're educated, you're not educated, all of the things that we find to divide on. But folks, you see, we're trying to repair the problems created by the absolute earthquake that has taken place that has divided us spiritually. And another denomination is only going to add another fracture to that. These are factions. Do you know that that's what Paul called them? He says that he was speaking about the factions in his list of things. Well, you know what a faction is? It's a denomination. It's this faction, or that some other faction. And he's talking about how factions are completely against the gospel altogether. You say, well, what's the difference between the gospel revolution and the factions? Because the factions exclude us and every other faction they know of. What's the difference about us? We include every faction. There is no faction left out of the gospel. This is a truth that transcends us, folks. This is bigger than us. This isn't just because the group is the size of the group or as big or as large as it could possibly be. That is not the definition of the truth of the gospel. The gospel, we see all as equal, whether they agree with us or not, on any level or any race. You'd be surprised how your racism will disappear once you understand the gospel. It just begins to fade away. You just wake up changed. You just wake up and things look different. Things are different. You feel different. And everything you learn about the gospel is going to constantly cause the things that fragment in our lives right down the middle of us. And Wade could tell you how fragmented he was, split down the middle and quartered out four different ways as to this part of his life, this part of his life. And that's what put me in the mental institution, was this fragmentation of my soul. Why do I stand before you sane and healthy and stable? Did I actually say that? And that is the diagnosis of a well-renowned doctor from the back row. Oh my goodness. Verse 5, who serve unto the example. It's a wonderful thing to weep because of beauty and joy instead of sadness, depression, 6 terms in mental institutions and lockup wards. I thought the reason I wound up there was because I was gay, only to find out the reason I was there was because of the religion that condemned me. I missed the opportunity of an education. Couldn't possibly have gone to school if I'd tried. Panic attacks. If anybody here has had a panic attack, you know you've had a panic attack. I used to have 50 of them a day, at least. And one will put you in the hospital. People that's never had a panic attack, if you have one, you'll go to the hospital immediately because you'll be sure that you're dying and be convinced that you are having a heart attack. I remember being so numb inside, I couldn't cry. It didn't do any good to cry. There was just no reason, because tears weren't going to repair anything. The only thing you know how to do is just to numb yourself. No sense out of anything. No reality. Lost in a blinding storm of pain. I never got involved in cutting myself or any of those things like that. But I certainly understand it, because I tell you what, when everything inside goes dark, when the lights go out, when you don't feel anything enough, you can't feel enough to cry, you can't feel enough to scream, you can't feel anything. Physical pain is a pleasure. It makes you realize you're alive. Most of what people do that are on self-destruct, they are simply trying to find something that makes them feel alive, because they feel dead. Now, for some reason, as I'm reading through this morning, the contrast is so stark. And when I realized that the things that I thought were wrong with me didn't create all of that, it was my Christianity that created all that. And I stand here before you tonight, this morning. I don't know what those things are like anymore. As Wade was talking about last night, about the man he talked to about, you know, I'd love to know what it was like for 10 seconds to not feel guilt. I can't count the number of years now that I haven't experienced guilt, not one single time. I don't know what that feeling is anymore. I don't know what shame is. I just think it would be just such a bizarre experience to feel ashamed. I don't even know what that is. You see, we go into this gospel, into the detail that we do, because I'm convinced that if we share it enough ways, it's kind of like throwing the spaghetti at the refrigerator, you know? And you just got to see what sticks. You don't know. You don't know what you're going to say. Some of the strangest things, some people have come to me and told me, you know, Mike, I was listening to you share, and when you said this or that, and it's like, really? Of all the wonderful, fantastic, great things that I said that were so brilliant, that's what got to you? So we don't know. So we keep trying. We keep trying, going at it every way. I don't know how many times, goodness, I've come up here this second time in a row, we've taught on Hebrews. And I may teach on Hebrews again next time. I don't know. Ah, goodness. Sorry for the interlude. The gospel is the power of God, that is for sure. It says, for see, saith he, that thou shalt make all things according to the pattern shown to thee in the mount. Now, let me start in verse 6 again. Who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, and Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern shown unto thee in the mount. Now you see the blueprint for the physical tabernacle that was created, that was came into the mind of God before the foundation of the world, came to Moses, and he said, now you're going to do this. Now we're going to take this from our realm, and we're going to put one of these in a physical building on this realm, because we need to begin to explain to the population of earth how this is going to transpire, how we're going to get into our new house. We want to show you the value, because what are we going to do? Live in them and that not have any clue as to what the value of that is? You know, whoever lives in the property, it causes the property values to go up or go down. Verse 6. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which is established upon better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for a second, for finding fault with them. Now, we've got to make sure we're keeping our focus on whom he is talking about. When he says for finding fault with them, who did he find fault with? It wasn't the people. Who was the guy in charge that was supposed to take the sacrifice and take it into the Holy of Holies and pick out? Who was the guy? That was the priest. So what was the problem? God found fault with the priest, right? This is the problem. This is the problem in this brand new thing that we're doing here, is there's a problem with the priest. The priest is not perfect. What were the problems with the priest that was pointed out? There's two problems with the priest. One is that he dies. Big problem. You got to pick a new priest all the time, because one's going to die. In fact, they could die in the middle of their service in the Holy of Holies. So much was the possibility. And I'm seeing God enduring this And because, you know, here's a perfect, holy, and righteous God saying, okay, if you'll just get ceremonially prepared, and if you do everything to specification, you can go in and offer the sacrifice. But they were, the people were so unsure of their priest, they tied a rope around his waist. And at the end of that, and on that rope, at the end of his robe was a bell. And as he was doing the service, they would hear ding, ling, ling, ding, ling, ling, ding, ling, ling. What does that mean? The priest is in there doing his service. So once the bell stopped ringing, they had a rope, because who's going to go get this dead carcass out of the Holy of Holies? If this man didn't went through all the purification rites, some of which he would have known only himself, because everybody wouldn't have known them, what's going to happen if the guy drops dead in there while trying to perform this service for us, in our place, for us? And if when the bells stopped ringing, that's when they grabbed hold of that rope and just started pulling on it. And, you know, that's a very visual picture for me. I'm sure there were steps up to the Holy of Holies, because I just see his body going clunk, 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 clunk. So for finding fault with them, he saith. So he found fault with the priesthood. Now remember, all the way through this, what you're going to learn out of this chapter 8 is God dealt with those who were over the people, not with the people. Now, that was all set as a pattern to show us how that God was going to perfect the human race for him to make the final move in. And he says, for finding fault with them, he saith, behold, the days cometh, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. Now, that sounds like all the people, doesn't it? But what did we just read three chapters back? Moses builded the house, but who has more honor? The one that is the house. The house hath more honor than the one who built it, right? So when he's talking about the house here, who's he talking about? He's talking about Christ. Christ is the house. I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. And it says, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers. Now here, once again, I want you to see that the covenant wasn't made with the people. It was made with their fathers. It was made with Moses. It was made with, you can go down through the list. God didn't get them all together and say, hey, let's come up with a covenant with you folks. Everybody take a vote on it. Let's figure this out. God just always dealt with just one person in representation of all of Israel. So the covenant was never made with all the people. According to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand and led them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant and I regarded them not. Now, why do you not want a covenant with God? Because if you don't keep your part, God don't keep his part. You don't want a covenant with God. In fact, the problem was finding someone, even just one of the fathers, to keep the covenant. Abraham, what he had to do with Abraham, the frustration he must have gone through with Abraham. And the fact he says, gosh, I keep trying to make covenants, but so now I'm going to do it between me and me for Abraham. And remember we read that verse that says, for when he had endured patiently... don't think that was Abraham who endured patiently, but instead God that was enduring patiently with Abraham. He said, I made with their fathers in the land when I took them by the hand. Now he said, I'm not going to make this kind of covenant again. I'm not going to make a covenant whereby I take them by the hand and lead them out of the land of Egypt. I'm not going to make a covenant where I take them by the hand. I am not going to make a covenant where I take them by the hand. I am not going to make a covenant whereby I take them by the hand. I'm going to move in. Better plan, right? Instead of taking you by the hand, he decided to move in. He said, he said, when they didn't keep my covenant, I didn't regard them. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. Now, what is the house of Israel? According to Hebrews, that's Christ. This is the covenant I'll make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws in their mind and write them upon the tables of their heart, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. Now, last fall, Wade, I caught him back there talking to some people. And I happened to overhear a conversation. And he made the statement that he said, God didn't write that old law on my heart. And that's like, okay, so I'm listening now. Now I'm eavesdropping, you know. And so I was listening to what he had to say, and it was just ringing with such truth inside of me. I couldn't wait to get into it and study it. But you see, that's not your heart where God's law was written. That lot was written on the house of Israel. We've already identified the house here several times, right? The house of Israel is Jesus Christ himself. Jesus took that law into his own heart, and it killed him, because the law brings death. How did Jesus take the law to the tree? It was written upon his heart before he died. And when his heart stopped beating, the law died. Now, I got that revelation praying and fasting, eavesdropping. Oh, man. Now, as a result of that law being written on Christ's heart, and Christ's heart stopped beating and taking the law away, this is the result. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and iniquities will I remember no more. Now, the term here, remember, means I will neither reward nor punish their deeds ever again. Now, folks, if you're going to do away with the punishment part of this equation, you got to do away with the reward part too. We've got to accept that the reward is Christ in us, the hope of glory. You see, the punishment reward system died, written on the heart of Christ when his heart stopped beating on that cross. Wow, I should be crying here instead of earlier. I mean, in that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which is decayeth, that which decayeth and waxeth old, is ready to vanish, disappear, go away, not be revitalized, revamped, and divided up almost 45,000 times. It's done with. It's out. It's gone. And because of that, you see all of the things that were needed to lead us up to this final point. You know, I can't prove this, but I can tell you how this looks in my brain. In my brain, because of finding this, and I attribute Don Bartlett, who gently beat me over the head with it, of getting the understanding that this plan of salvation didn't start after the fall in the garden. You see, I was chained to that concept that everything happened because man fell. But you see, what I needed to do was expand my view to where that this this total end of beginning and end of creation was all planned out in the heart of God before the foundation of the world, before there was let there be light. You existed in the mind of God before let there be light. Is part of the blueprint. It was a part of the seeing how this would all work. What would it look like for God to live in man? What would it look like for man to be God? What's that all going to look like? And man, I'm telling you what, the process of this. Once my mind expanded around that understanding, then I saw, I didn't see a fall. I didn't see all of these, because that term's not, you do know that term's not in the Bible, right? The fall of man, that's just not in the Bible at all. The experience is what we call the fall is in the Bible. But you can tell God did not seem surprised about it whatsoever, right? I mean, there was no surprise on his part that this happened. And as I've often said, when God came down in the cool of the day, there were only two human beings on the planet, and he comes down, he knows they're in a certain place, and he goes around yelling, "Hey, Adam, where are you?" And I remember years ago, it finally dawned on me, God wasn't calling because he had lost the only two people on earth. He was trying to help Adam understand where he was. And now, just like in the Garden of Eden, it's vitally important we understand where we are. It's vitally important that we know where he is. Because the most incredible thing has happened, and that is the completion of creation that took place 2,000 years ago. Many people say the completion of creation took place after the seventh day. I think the completion of creation took place 2,000 years ago. And that creation became so alive, so different, so vibrant, so filled with possibilities, so filled with, and we see glimmers of it, and we are walking in a time that just within my lifetime, the science, the understanding, the architect, the possibilities, the things that are helping us understand. If you think there's not going to be bumps along the way as we try to figure this out, it's never not been bumps in the road along the way. I just flipped on my TV the other day. I grew up in a generation in my life where Hep C was a death sentence, hepatitis C. And I flip on the TV, and they're advertising a medication. Oh, if you have Hep C, now it doesn't make any difference which kind. There's several forms of Hep C. Here's a pill we want you to tell your doctors about, because all you have to do is take this pill for 8 months, and you will, it's either 8 months or 8 weeks. And after, it was 8 weeks, wasn't it, Leslie? 8 weeks. 8 weeks. Take this one pill for 8 weeks, and you will be cured of hepatitis C. And I looked around, and I was like, what? Are you now telling me that there is a cure for something that used to kill everybody that had it? And we're just, it's a commercial? Folks, this ought to be more than a commercial. This ought to be occupying every news network around the world to explain this and tell people how this major breakthrough has taken place and that a killer of people of every race and color and persuasion of any kind has killed people, millions of people around the earth for thousands of years, is now a 8-week tablet-taking cure. You say, Mike, what do you call that? I call that God in man. That's what I call that. Along with so many other things. Folks, the trajectory that we are on, I realize that many people are upset about where we are. Some people aren't upset. Do you realize some people aren't upset about where we are because it agrees with their entire psychology about life? Some people aren't upset at all. Some people are terribly upset. But let me tell you, whichever side we tend to lean to, don't worry. Your side's going to get in place sometime. It always does that. This thing swings back and forth. We are like a drunken sailor walking down a 6-lane highway. Sometimes we walk straight into traffic, and sometimes we actually are smart enough to walk with the traffic, even though we shouldn't be out there at all. But we're going to make it. Things are getting better. And regardless of where you stand, let me encourage you to encourage everybody around you that regardless of how desperately we need to tend to things at this present time, please don't lose sight of that fact. God lives in the human race, and we're getting better at this. And we're going to continue to get better at it. And this gospel that we're sharing with you, I don't know that, Apollos said, you know, we have many things to say unto you, but they're very hard to be uttered because you're dull of hearing. You see, the problem that's happening right now is we have many things to say. They are hard to, what makes them hard for us to utter? Because people aren't ready to hear it yet. But they will. They will. In my heart and mind, these little meetings right here, because I believe this is absolute truth. I don't think that this is anything else but truth because it includes everyone. That's why I'm convinced. Who knows? You know, we remember certain little meetings that took place 500 years ago when this group got together, that group got together, and they decided this and they decided that. Who knows that one of these meetings, this meeting, could show up somewhere 500 years from now and begin to impact the way the world thinks because they've experienced enough to know that the way they're doing it just doesn't work. Good news. Always stick within your heart good news, because that's what's going to keep your mind revitalized. That's what's going to keep your emotions stable. Stick with the good news. That's what the gospel means. It just means good news. We are going to give you an opportunity to comment. Tell me what a blubber butt I am. Whatever you would like to say. What's wrong with you? I couldn't hardly get off of verse 2. Anybody got something to say? Anybody else want to hug me? Boy, I'm sounding really desperate now, aren't I? All right. Yeah. Thank you.
I need a hug.
Uh-oh, my goodness.
I love hugs.
Now, does anybody have a comment, a question, an insult? I need to be insulted a little bit after all that loving. You can use it as a holy grail. You can.
It's so great to feel that overwhelming, whether it be flow of tears, as the gospel, and that's what I was thinking about God's two-edged sword, his powerful words going into us and doing that healing to, it's so powerful, it's so overwhelming that it brings us to a spot where we just have to stop and feel that healing. And I feel that that was in those verses, that was the message.
Yeah.
Was so clear as to how we were planned.
Yeah.
And how we were, you know, like in the shadows to see all the needs and everything that Christ had to do and be for us.
Yes.
His was a big job.
Yeah.
We just kind of had to hang around and you know, play act a bit. But he had to do a lot.
Yeah.
He had to stand in the place of every person that exists.
Yeah.
And that's powerful.
It is
to know
powerful.
He did that for us.
I think for me that the thing that touches me so deeply is that broader picture that my mind has expanded to. It just seems like all limitations for the possibility of thought have been removed now. I'm not governed by anything that, and this is something that is so powerful to me, that the gospel transcends time. The gospel was conceived before time began. Isn't that amazing? The gospel was conceived in the heart of God before time began, before any of this revolving and rotation and sun and earth and seed time and harvest. The gospel itself had already been done. Seed time and harvest and the sun and the moon, see, these are all just here to give us examples of the story that took place before there was let there be light. Anybody else? Something you learned? Something you want to just say a little bit more about?
I wasn't really sure how to think or where to wrap my mind around the. We were talking earlier about every atom, every proton, every neutron, all these things, and I was thinking about that last night and this morning, how if God's going to live in us, He needs a lot of space. Mm-hmm. He needs a whole galaxy. And that's what we are.
Yeah. And that's what a way to explain to you last night, you are.
And that's what we need to be to house God is a whole solar system. Yeah.
God went from outer space to inner space.
Yes.
There you go. And they do. And physics tells you that inner space is just as large and maybe infinitely larger than outer space.
Mike, I just wanted to say that beautiful picture you painted of God and Jesus planning this whole thing out. You actually, I just kept getting the image of a realtor going, location, location, location.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, and we became the perfect location and well delivered. Thank you so much for that.
Oh, thank you so much.
I just wanted to say again, Mike, it's always an honor to come and it's like you give me mind expansion. When you say something from that little podium, my brain goes off like in a kaleidoscope of fireworks. And I'm sitting here with the same emotion. There's just something charged in this room today.
Yeah.
That is, when truth shows up, it brings with it rejoicing.
Yeah.
And today I'd just like to holler. But I'm suppressing this. In the UK, they've developed a powerful microscope that can view a million times deeper, greater than the breadth of a human hair. And so scientists have dived down deep into minuscule particles. And they find order and color and beauty that is just indescribable. A million times tinier than a human hair. Yeah. And here we've got structure.
Yes.
It's an amazing creation. This thing was well thought out.
Well thought out.
And today, to see the unfolding of that and all the pictures and places, and you study the Old Testament, and it is a... it's a photo album with pictures of Christ on every page.
Yeah.
And he is Aaron's rod that budded in. He is the laver and the candlestick, and he is the manna, and he is the mercy seat, and he is the veil. And when the New Testament really began in Matthew 27:51, and the veil was rent from top to bottom, that was like the ribbon cutting service for God to move in. That is a phenomenal thing, and everybody on this planet needs to hear what was said in this room today. You just don't get this from factions.
No, you don't.
This is the cure for racism. Mm-hmm. I have black friends and Native Indian friends and Islamic friends, and they to know that they are absolutely the same dwelling place of the Most High that I am, just drives all that right out of your feet.
Yeah. Seems silly, doesn't it?
It's such a futile waste of, but you know, I played a little golf, and a couple weeks ago, my wife was she's addicted. And she came home with her first hole in one. She was golfing in Invermere, and she was so elated about that that I had to grease her head to get her through the door. And golf, one of the great professionals said that golf is played on a 5.5-inch fairway that exists between your ears.
Yeah.
And I thought, golf is like the game of life. We've got hazards and bunkers and stuff you can get involved in, and you try to aim that ball the best you can, but you're going to shank some shots. I've seen golfers drive clubs into the trees. They're so fed up.
Yeah.
So, but the game of life is played really on that 5.5 inches between your ears. But the apostle said, but we have the mind of Christ. Mm-hmm. And it makes a whole lot better game if you just think from the mind of Christ and play that little game with that in mind, that he has moved in and we have his mind. And we all, I know things are allowed and not all things are beneficial. And we beat ourselves up sometimes, or we've tried to. And there have been times when I was going through my morphing stage, and I'd look up and I'd do something wrong, and I'd look up and I'd say, Father, do you see that? And he says, what? Mm-hmm. When I look at you, I see me. I see righteousness.
Yeah.
What are you talking to me about? And it's not a blind side. It's not oblivion. It's just that he loves his house.
That's truth.
Yes. I said to my wife this morning before I left, I said, I love this house. And I instantly got that, that sentiment inside that almost brings you to tears, where God looks at me and says, I love this house.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, he does love this house.
I'm just impressed with the gospel.
Yeah.
And I like to call it the good news. I prefer the good news as opposed to the gospel, because I find the gospel is kind of a religious term.
Yes.
But I like the good news, and I just appreciate you, Mike, more all the time for bringing that message to us. And it just encourages me to, you know, just to rejoice in that, and to keep looking for more of those veins of gold that are out there in the gospel, in the good news. So thanks. Thanks very much for coming again.
You're very welcome. And I would like for all of us to stop for just a moment and give Vic and those that are here, we have two of the guys here that are responsible for putting us on, and let's give them just a real thank you, because if these guys did not put the effort into doing this, we would not have a place to meet. So thank you guys so much, both of you. Thank you. Thank you.